Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. Visit speakuptalkradio.com. And today's guest fits the bill of an important person with something to say that you need to hear. He is Joe Lurie. Joe is Executive Director Emeritus of the University of California, Berkeley's International House, a dynamic multinational residential program center serving the campus, local community, and 1,000 residents from 75-plus countries annually. Its mission is to foster intercultural respect and understanding for the promotion of a more peaceful world. A former Peace Corps volunteer in Kenya, Joe directed programs in France, Kenya, and Ghana for the School for International Training, and served as vice president for AFS Intercultural Programs in the United States and National Study Abroad Chair for NAFSA, Association of International Educators. He was featured in a PBS documentary broadcast across the United States and in China and has been interviewed by the Travel Channel. Joe holds an advanced degree and diploma in African Studies and an MA in English. Now, as an author, UC Berkeley lecturer, intercultural trainer, consultant, and speaker, Joe continues to promote greater understanding across cultures. And today, we are going to talk about his recent book titled Perception and Deception, A Mind-Opening Journey Across Cultures. And I am honored to bring him to you. So welcome to the show, Joe Lurie.
Nice to be with you, Pat. Thank you very much for your invitation.
Oh, it is our pleasure. I took a peek at your book and I thought, I need to get this gentleman on the show with us. Well, today we are going to have a mini masterclass of miscommunication when it comes to cultural differences and the problems we encounter not only as individuals, but as a group or even as a nation, when we look at things solely through our own lens. But before we go there, give us, if you would, a quick ride on the Joe Lurie train and tell us what experiences actually led you to write this book.
You know, when I look back at this, Pat, I think back to my Peace Corps experience where I was a volunteer in Kenya back in the late 60s. And I discovered how much I didn't know about the rest of the world, about Africa, about Kenya, and ultimately about myself. And just to give you a very quick sense of this, flying to Nairobi via Entebbe in Uganda, we stopped for a fueling stop in Entebbe. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, got out of the plane, sniffed the air, heavy, humid, and I had this immediate sensation that I was smelling lion. And I remember saying this to a fellow volunteer at the time. Of course, later on, I was surprised to learn that there were no lions within 30 miles of that airport. And it just kind of was the beginning of an alert that because there are so many one-dimensional perceptions of Africa, that so many of us know so little about Africa, mm-hmm. And that the media is flooded with images of safaris and lions and, of course, generally AIDS, poverty, etc., that my narrative was so entrenched, as is still to the case today, with the notion of safaris and wild animals, that my senses were deceived. Mm-hmm. It was an immediate sense of perception and deception. And so the rest of my time in Kenya over 3 years was a huge exploration of what I was looking at that I didn't understand, what I wasn't seeing accurately, both from my perspective and the perspective of Kenyans who were observing me. Mm-hmm. And that was really the beginning of a journey of exploring other cultures, my own perspectives and perceptions, and that's really what led to the book, the first chapter of which actually is about my experiences in Kenya.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Now, did Berkeley, the International House, was that after Peace Corps?
That was after Peace Corps.
Okay.
I served as executive director there from 88 to 2007.
All right, maybe just for some of the listeners who may not know, what exactly goes on at Berkeley's International House?
So it's really kind of one of the most unusual institutions. There are other major international houses around the world, but in essence, it was created so that people could, from many, many, many countries, and the one in Berkeley, for example, has close to 600 students from 80 countries and 25 states at any one given time. So by an intense, prolonged living experience where they're also sharing programs, interacting with the community, there's this amazing sense of discovery that goes on at the International House. I'm just thinking, you know, right off the top of my head, just to give you one example of something that happens at International House where, for example, a Chinese student said to an American student a couple of years ago, "Have you eaten?" Well, you know, many of your listeners would perhaps respond by saying, "No, you know, I haven't eaten. Would you like to go out for lunch?"
Mm-hmm.
The American student did. And the Chinese student response was, "I've already had lunch," and just continued to walk down the hallway. Well, it turns out that we all, when we speak another language, translate something that doesn't always translate. Mm-hmm. So have you eaten? In Chinese, actually in Thai, in Korean, really means how are you?
Mm-hmm.
So this American was completely imprisoned by his prism of thinking he was being invited to lunch.
Oh, my. That is a great example. And so I imagine between what you did in the Peace Corps and then at Berkeley's International House, and you were kind of entrenched in seeing all of this, and I'm sure all of that was excellent food for your impetus to write the book.
It was, and I actually devoted a chapter to these extraordinary encounters. I mean, can you imagine people from 80 countries and 25 states living together, sharing bathrooms together, everything from lunch to laundry to love affairs.
Wow.
Was a cross-cultural and continues to be a cross-cultural encounter.
How exciting, huh?
Yeah.
All right, we're going to get into some of those individual situations in a minute, but you say that the growing misperception and misunderstanding across cultures is directly linked to globalization. Give us some examples of that.
Well, you know, my sense of globalization is that the world is coming together, converging, let me put it that way, converging so quickly because of internet, technology, relative ease of travel compared to 10, 15, 20, 50 years ago, that often this contact between cultures is abrupt and without context. Let me give you a very specific example that happened recently. It's not in the news, but it's not in the book, but it kind of illustrates many of the stories I tell in the book. I was coaching an immigrant from Egypt, extremely talented woman, articulate, long background in IT, business development, and she had a great resume, but nobody would interview her. And I said, "Well, why do you think that is? Is it because you're from Egypt?" She said, "No, I don't think that's the case." I said, "Well, what do you think it is?" She said, "Well, my name is Fadwa." Now, when I say Fadwa, let me spell that for you and your audience, Pat. F-A-D-W-A.
Okay.
Fadwa in Arabic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't speak Arabic in this country. Means self-sacrifice, sacrifice for others. But if you don't speak Arabic, what do you hear? You hear the narrative that is fatwa, right?
Yep.
A religious command often associated with, or certainly at times associated with terrorism.
Right.
So when they saw the name Fatwa, they said, "I'm not going to interview her. She must be a terrorist."
My.
Now, here is a brilliant woman who, because of her name and because of a narrow prism, wasn't even interviewed. So she had to change her name to Fadiwa, F-A-D-I-W-A, so people wouldn't hear the word fatwa.
Wow.
Right?
Right.
So, you know, this is an example, a very dramatic example of how, given globalization, given the times in which we're living, somebody could be misperceived, not accurately assessed. I'll give you another example from International House way back after 9/11, of course, which was a highly polarizing time.
I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was a staff member at IHouse who was an Iranian Muslim who was married to an Iraqi Jew. Yeah, it's possible. So after 9/11, because of their background, their Middle Eastern background, all of a sudden somebody came to their door and knocked on the door and said, "Where's the anthrax?"
Oh.
Okay. Now you remember after 9/11, there were great and understandable concerns about anthrax.
Right.
And the FBI agents came in. They said, "Where's the anthrax? Where's that white powder?" They said, "Well, I don't know what you're talking about. The only white powder we have here is on the kitchen table." And it so happens that a plumber, a couple of days right after 9/11, saw this white powder on their table, reported them to the FBI, and what was the white powder?
Sugar.
Mm-hmm. right? So basically, another case of here's a couple is basically bridging cultural and religious differences,
mm-hmm.
right? And because of that, and the prism that was associated with the drama of the moment, right?
Yes.
Was missed. And then let me give you one other example, just to give this a sense, because this continues to this day. I don't know to what extent your listeners are familiar with the Sikh community.
Okay.
The Sikh community actually there's about 500,000 Sikhs who live in the United States. They are not Hindus, and they are not Muslims. Their own religion. And because they wear turbans, because they don't cut their hair. And they don't cut their hair because in their religion, the hair is considered to be a gift of God. But wearing turbans post 9/11 and even to this day, Sikh temples have been attacked because of the prism of the turban being associated with Osama bin Laden.
Right.
So think about this, for example, in the context of the health situation. If a Sikh, and by the way, they call themselves Sikhs, not Sikhs.
Mm.
And the reason they don't refer to themselves as Sikhs is because to an American ear or a British ear or an English-speaking ear, it sounds like you're sick.
Right.
So they call themselves Sikhs.
Interesting.
So let's say you go to the hospital and you're a Sikh and you have, or a Sikh, as they would say, and you are being asked to have an angiogram. Let's say you've got a heart condition. And the doctor immediately, as in many hospitals, will start to shave the hair off the bottom, you know, the inside of your thigh.
Right.
Well, if you're a Sikh, you might very well freak out that you're cutting, the hair is being cut.
Mm-hmm.
What would the doctor know? Absence of context.
Right.
What would the Sikh know?
Mm-hmm.
So this is just another example of how the absence of understanding of what an ibnj means, what hair means, what a turban means, all of these things can have a different significance across cultures. Sounds, images, touch, all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what drove me to write the book, to say, okay, every single thing you can think of that we think is normal may well have a different significance in a different cultural environment.
Right. Very, very fascinating, and especially in these times today with technology and all of the social media that we have. I was wondering from you, do you find that social media contributes to some of these misunderstandings? Or does it exacerbate it, let's say?
Well, you know, I think it can go two ways. Social media is an abbreviation for the kind of ways that, I mean, I was brought up. We used to write full sentences, paragraphs. Now, of course, things come very rapidly in tweets.
Right.
So the rapidity of a tweet, which can be very effective in many situations, is that it often lacks context. So when somebody sends you a tweet, it could have a meaning that is totally escaping you because there's an absence of context or because you come from a different culture, even within our own culture. So LOL, for example, mm-hmm. LOL, right?
Right.
Laugh out loud, that's what I gather it means to most young people, right?
Right.
So I have a niece who sent that message to her mother. What was the mother's prism? Lots of love.
Oh.
Because that was what she associated with laugh out loud.
Interesting.
So again, even within our own culture, we assess the meaning of our interactions with people within and across cultures based on our prism.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this Chinese poem that I use as a metaphor in the book, and that is basically, how shall I explain the sea to a frog that has never left its pond? Well, all of us have ponds. Some of our ponds are bigger than others, but we're all limited by the pond that we were raised in and our experience. No matter how well traveled, there's a point at which I don't understand what's beyond
mm-hmm.
the pond.
Wow.
And with all of my experience in living in other countries and interacting with people from other cultures, I find this all the time.
And I think that the African proverb that you talk about in your book, I wrote these two little lines down, that the stranger sees only what he knows.
Right.
I mean, that's very important. And then you also say that we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. And
exactly.
That kind of wraps it all up, doesn't it?
Well, in many ways. And, you know, one of the ways that I tried to illustrate it, began to discover this all, was when in Kenya, where people who are elders are much respected, right? And when a young man calls an elder grandma, within most African cultures, that is a term of great respect.
Mm-hmm.
But if a young man says that to someone he doesn't know who comes from, let's say, Europe or the United States, that person, let's say they're in their 60s or their 70s, they may take that as an insult. Why are you calling me grandma? I mean, even in our own culture, we refer to senior citizens. We don't want to say that you're old. The word old has negative connotations in our society. And in other societies, for the most part, particularly non-Western societies, it is a revered word.
Right.
So you could be insulting somebody without knowing it by calling them old.
Mm-hmm.
And when you might mean the greatest of respect.
Yeah. Yeah, you could get yourself in a lot of trouble, right?
You could.
Exactly. I want to pop back to your book for a moment. Tell us about the cow on the cover of your book. What is the significance of that?
You know, when I thought about writing, putting something on the cover that would capture the essence of the book, what can I put on the cover of the book that will illustrate that when we look at something, we all see something different? So for a Hindu, the cow is sacred. I mean, you see even the images of cows wandering the streets of big cities in India, because they're sacred. They contribute so much to the society from the Hindu point of view. Their milk, the fact that their manure is used for fertilizer, and so cows are not killed by Hindus. If you come from a society, and there are many, where the cow represents wealth and is given to the family of a prospective spouse, they might say they might see the cow as symbolic of dowry.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, divine on the face of the cow, dowry. Or if you're a meat eater, you might think, dinner.
Yep.
So, and then even within India, which has, most people don't realize, the second largest Muslim population in the world, even though it's predominantly a Hindu country, overwhelmingly over 80% of the people are Hindu. If you're a Muslim, you do eat meat. And so you can see even within India, within every country,
mm-hmm.
it's not just a question of the United States and other countries. Within every country, people are imprisoned by their prison.
Yes.
For a while, I thought I would put the back of a bald head on the cover, because somebody might see a skinhead. Somebody might see a soldier. Another person, depending on their prism and their life experience, might see a cancer survivor,
yep. Yep.
So that's why I put the cow on the cover. I said, well, first of all, people don't often see pictures of cows on a cover that says divine dowry or dinner.
No, that's for sure.
It was meant to be kind of an eye catcher.
It is. That's why I asked. I thought it was excellent choice. Let's talk about some more cross-cultural conundrums that you highlight in your book. You talked about footprints on the toilet seats. There's a good one.
You know, this is... Again, as the world becomes smaller, people are traveling more, we become exposed to different toilet habits. And I discovered in an international house, there were people from many parts of the world where people don't sit on toilets. They come from parts of the world where you're used to crouching. So if you're used to crouching, it's not normal, it doesn't feel comfortable to sit. And there was an article recently about the Chinese tourists in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And there was this mysterious, why are so many toilet seats being broken? And it's because most Chinese people, of course they have sit-down toilets, but generally speaking, the vast majority of Chinese people and most people in India and most people in Asia and most people in Africa do not sit on toilets.
Mm-hmm.
They crouch.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they come across a sit-down toilet, they will get on it and crouch. So they'll either break the toilet seat or leave their footprints there, which is, of course, a great conundrum for people who walk into a toilet and see footprints. And they say, good God, what's going on? And actually, this, you know, from a health perspective,
yes.
I know some of the folks in your audience are interested in health issues. Generally speaking, Western doctors now have said that the crouch position is a much healthier way to have a bowel movement.
Mm-hmm.
And there are now in the United States, because of this gradually, this is one of the pluses of globalization, though, in discovering things about each other's cultures. We have a lot to teach other cultures. We have a lot to learn from other cultures. But in this convergence of cultures, we learn, gee, maybe it is better to crouch. And so now there's actually a product, you can Google it, called a squatty potty.
Yes, yes. My brother has
permits
one.
Permits you to mm-hmm. squat while you're sitting on the toilet.
Yep.
It's a good compromise.
Well, and if you even think health-wise, just the cross-contamination, why anyone would sit on a toilet that someone else sat on, that's almost a bizarre thought.
It is indeed. And
mm-hmm.
for example, you know, even this question of cleanliness. What is clean?
Yes.
How do we define cleanliness?
Yeah.
Why is it that most Americans still, to this day, when we come into our houses, we come into our houses with our shoes on? This is something that I've been doing all my life until I started traveling to other parts of the world and realizing that in, I would say, probably the majority of countries in the world, people consider shoes to be dirty because
yep.
you're walking around in them all day, so there's dirt on the bottom.
Yes.
Why would you want to bring that into your house?
Right.
And that's why when we, for example, in a relaxed mode, feeling very comfortable when we cross our legs, without knowing it, let's say we're in a country where dirty feet are considered really an insult, we could be insulting the person next to us because of the exposed sole.
Mm.
And actually, it has significance, and I do write about this in the book, for example, in Afghanistan, a lot of the American soldiers who didn't get cultural training were sitting on the ground with their feet pointed outward. And they were unknowingly and without intention having them point at Afghans.
Oh.
And in some cases, it enraged them.
Interesting.
Without knowing it. Now, you may remember when Saddam Hussein was overthrown. Iraqis, when his statue came down, Iraqis were beating the head of Saddam Hussein with their shoes, the statue.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just anger being expressed by hitting the statue. It was the ultimate shoe insult.
Insult. Mm-hmm.
But how would we know that?
Yeah.
If we're used to, you know, crossing our legs and having the sole of our foot, and, you know, of course, the stereotype of a business person who puts his feet up on the table.
Right.
I think this would offend a lot of Americans.
Yes.
Well, let's not overgeneralize about this, but it continues to bring the story home that what we're used to is a narrative and a pattern that we are brought up with and which on some levels liberate us, but it can also imprison us.
Mm-hmm. And they're very hard to break. As you were saying that I grew up in an Italian home, and so taking our shoes off at the door is what we did. And even to this day, when people enter my home and just walk right in, I get irritated by that. I'm like, really?
Right, right. So you, and that's part of what's normal for you, and don't they understand?
Yeah. Wow, this is fascinating. There's so many more in your book. Talk about a written contract. Is it a source of comfort or distrust? Talked about washing dirty underwear with shirts. And, you know, in some cultures, they wouldn't even think of washing their underwear with the rest of their clothes. Smiling at strangers. I mean, we have a tendency to do that.
Right. And it's meant to be warm and welcoming. But in many cultures, why would I even want to smile at somebody I don't know?
Mm-hmm.
I see this on university campuses all the time. Many of the students that I have met over the years would say to me, why are these people smiling?
Yeah.
Know them. And then they come to realize, and then they say, you know, I understand this now. But, for example, this can affect international business. For example, in a business context, a lot of Americans were brought up with the notion, okay, let's have an agenda. Let's talk about the issue. Let's see if we can get a deal here, et cetera, et cetera. And when the Americans traditionally have gone abroad, they were shocked that many of their hosts, particularly in Asia and Africa, would spend a couple of days wining and dining them because they wanted to get to know them. And the Americans, I got to get a plane, I got to get home.
Mm-hmm.
And so the notion of a good, successful business deal is often based on, I need to feel I can trust you as a person. And that's why, from the perspective of some countries, a contract kind of implies, well, why do we have to write everything down? It kind of implies we don't trust each other.
Right. Wow.
Well, of course, it works in our society. The question is, the real challenge And the real discovery comes when you have a encounter between two different approaches to how do you make an agreement?
Mm-hmm.
How do you say no? How do you say yes? How do you praise someone without making them feel uncomfortable? I mean, it really it's a life journey of discovery that I continue to have every day. For example, yesterday I was in a cleaning shop, and I was saying thank you and giving my credit card for the materials I was getting, and the woman who was from Nepal, she gave me the receipt for my credit card with her right hand, because in many parts of the world you don't give things to people with your left hand. And then I noticed all of a sudden that she was taking her left hand and putting it under her elbow as she gave me the receipt. Okay? And so what that means is this is showing respect for an elder in Nepal.
Oh.
It's not just giving them something with your hand.
Mm-hmm.
It's putting the other hand under it and showing this level of respect.
Oh.
And for your listeners who've been to Asia, they've probably noticed that frequently a business card is given with two hands and received with two hands.
Right, kind of like a presentation.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And there's it's not a question of one is better than the other in most cases, but it's a question of it has a different meaning.
Mm-hmm. And in business, it can get very, very confusing. I used to own an American Indian art gallery for many, many years. And on my first foray into dealing with Native American artists, I found that the whole time concept was quite different. And you talked about trust in that it really took a long time to build that level of trust. But the time issue was a particular interest to me, where we needed a particular piece of art or, say, jewelry for a show opening that we were having. And it would be, yes, we'll get that to you soon. Well, soon often meant months beyond the date of the showing. And so my soon and their soon were not the same words.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, when we have stereotyped when Spanish speakers, particularly from Mexico, say mañana.
Mm-hmm.
It really means tomorrow. Well, mañana could mean next week, it could mean in a month, or we'll get it to you soon. And then also, of course, in many of the Native American communities, the notion of pausing. You ask somebody in a question, and often there's a long silence.
Yes.
And for those of us raised in the United States, many of us are turn-caking, and you say something, and then there's a response within a couple of seconds, maybe a second or two. And then if somebody has a long silence, you don't know exactly how to engage them,
mm-hmm.
whereas it might be perfectly normal to have a long silence before you respond.
Wow.
In the same way, if you go to parts of Latin America, if you're having a conversation with somebody and they're interrupting you, you might say, why don't you let me finish my sentence? And they might say, but the conversation is more interesting by engaging. Even in this country, one could make the argument that men tend to like to be much more linear, finish their sentences, and women like to be engaging more and interrupting. I've even said this to my wife for many years. She she will interrupt me while I was speaking, and I'll say, you know, Donna, why don't you let me finish my sentence? And then she says, but, you know, this is called active listening.
Oh, there you go. Oh, my goodness. So many ways we could take this here. I want to make sure that we're talking about everything that you want to talk about today. Is there anything that we're missing or an area that you want to head into that we haven't discussed?
Well, you know, the other thing I think is, you know, I think we're rightly proud in the United States to call ourselves an immigrant country, and every wave of immigrant has enriched us in different ways. And what I have noticed since my days of working at the International House at UC Berkeley, I've been spending a lot of time working with immigrants from all over the world who come here, very highly skilled, many of them, and yet they have a different approach to interviewing.
Mm.
So, for example, in many countries, when you're asked a question to talk about your accomplishments, you know, in an American job interview, we often say, tell me about your accomplishments. Well, if you're saying that to a very talented person from, it could be Africa, it could be Asia, from Latin America, many of them will say, not want to answer that question, because by pointing to yourself, you're being immodest.
Mm-hmm.
And many will even say, well, we did such and such, as opposed to I did such and such. And when I asked an immigrant from Ethiopia recently about this, he said, well, it is true, you know, I was part of the accomplishment, but I couldn't have done it without a team. And actually, Pat, believe it or not, in many cultures, people discourage their children from using the word I. So imagine somebody who's a brilliant person comes to an interview and they can't answer the question, tell me about your accomplishment. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I'll just give you a specific example recently that I encountered, and that was a gentleman from the Philippines, and I asked him to tell me about his profession, and his answer was this: I am just a doctor. Mm. Now, most of us in this country would say, I'm a doctor.
Right.
And I said, well, tell me a little bit about what kind of a doctor. And his response was, well, I've done a little bit of everything. I said, have you ever done any surgery? Oh, I've done a little of that. Have you ever done any transplants? I've done a little bit of that. So it turns out, to make a long story short, that he was the head of one of the largest clinics in the Philippines and had done all kinds of surgery, a very well-known person, but to actually talk about his accomplishment mm-hmm. was an embarrassment.
Wow.
In the book, you may have noticed there's this proverb, a Japanese proverb that says, when the nail sticks up, hammer it down.
Yes.
Don't draw attention to yourself. Mm-hmm. Whereas in our country, you're supposed to kind of, at least tastefully, be able to share your talents. Not as that you're a braggadocio, but you're basically saying, you know, this is what I did, mm-hmm. and I'm proud of it. And we, for example, will have a section on our resumes which says awards, special distinctions, right?
Right.
Rarely will you see that on resumes from non-Western countries. Mm-hmm. They don't want to draw attention to themselves because it interferes with the larger community. There's another great African proverb: if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Wow. Your book is a must-have for everyone. It really, really is. Where can folks then go to purchase the book, Perception and Deception, A Mind-Opening Journey Across Cultures?
Well, probably the easiest way, because, you know, it's just kind of getting out now beyond my pond here in California, is to go to Amazon mm-hmm. and just type in Perception and Deception, A Mind-Opening Journey Across Cultures. My name, Joe Lurie. It'll come up. You can get it on Kindle. There are a variety of electronic versions, I believe, of it. Certainly it's available on Kindle in Amazon, and the paperback, I think it's only $12.99, actually, or used copies, perhaps even less than that. Kindle is, I think, $7.99, as I recall. So that's probably the easiest way to do it. I do have a website, perceptionanddeception.com, one word, and that kind of gives a feeling. There's even kind of a section of the book to give people a little sense of what it's like, why I wrote it, and reviews of any number of people who were in the media, former ambassador, that kind of thing, who mm-hmm. have made me feel good about the kind of discoveries I wanted to share with the rest of the communities that I'm in touch with.
Excellent. Perceptionanddeception.com. And do you want to share some information if folks want to contact you for any of your cross-cultural communications trainings or consulting and speaking engagements?
Yeah, I do a lot of cross-cultural training for a variety of organizations, whether they're businesses or whether they're immigrant groups or whether they're Americans going abroad or whether they are people who are doing involved with multinational teams. So probably the best way to contact me is through my Gmail address, Joe Lurie, one word, J-O-E-L-U-R-I-E, @gmail.com, or they can find me on LinkedIn. All you have to do is type in Joe Lurie at LinkedIn in University of California, Berkeley, and that should get them there. There's a long profile of me there. And on the website, my book website, perceptionanddeception.com, there's also a kind of a profile of my activity.
Oh, I'm so excited to have had this opportunity to share you with our listeners today. And really, there's just so much more. Folks really need to get a copy of the book, Perception and Deception, A Mind-Opening Journey Across Cultures, at your website, perceptionanddeception.com. Joe, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to share you and your experience and wisdom with our listeners.
Many thanks for having me, Pat. I really enjoyed it.
If you have something to say or share and would like to be interviewed, we will feature you too on the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. Just visit the website speakuptalkradio.com or leave a message on our studio line 440-725-5462. Go ahead, speak up.